Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, we're talking pay to play, and I mean pay to play at the youth level, pay to play at the pro level, pay to play this way, that way, the other way, every which way here in American soccer. Everybody likes to say that is the root cause of all our ailings, but of course, it is not. And we will talk about why it is not and what actually is in today's episode. But you also want to know regarding playing time, because in the title itself, it suggests that if you pay, you will play. And we all know that isn't necessarily the case. Some youth players play a lot, some a little, some not at all. So what is fair? What isn't fair? This is the exploration that we have today. And we put ourselves in the shoes of the parents. We put ourselves in the shoes of the player. We put ourselves in the shoes of the coach. And I think that is a very insightful one because we don't really talk much about coaches and why they play certain players a lot and certain players not so much and some players not at all. And we don't talk about the pressures that coaches are under. We also put ourselves in the shoes of the clubs themselves. So ladies and gentlemen, we have an insightful discussion today on this topic. You will not get it in the mainstream, and that is what we are here for. Benny Rogers joins me once again for this one. And of course, before you head on into the episode, remember to visit 343coaching.com if you are a coach and want to gain access to the methodology that pioneered a revolution here in the United States with one of, if not the best youth coach. It's unlike anything else in the market. We have thousands of coaches who have joined the program, hundreds of them who took it seriously and catapulted their careers to levels that would not have occurred otherwise. And parents, you are not left behind. 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to also gain access to decades of the wisdom that was accrued along this journey of pioneering the American soccer frontier. Why do you need this? Well, I wouldn't blame you if you're confused about the youth soccer landscape here in American soccer. It is quite complicated, unfortunately, and it is not necessarily a meritocracy, unfortunately. So you need tools at your disposal to best guide your son or daughter. And again, I repeat, 343masterclass.com is the location for you. Finally, coaches who are coaching the little ones, I mean, you can go to 343coaching.com as well, but if you're coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, then 7v7coaching.com is the place for you. All right, everybody, enjoy this episode, gain a lot of insights. You can always email me at gary@343.com. As a follow-up, if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions, recommendations, I'm all ears. Here we go, pay to play with Benny Rogers.
So, Gary, I thought it'd be good to talk about something that came up in our last episode, and this is in regards to playing time, but not just playing time within the system of pay to play here in U.S. soccer. I think something that a lot of coaches are struggling with these days is the pressure from parents to, you know, play the players every single game, regardless of their merit or their performance in training. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure when the parents are paying over $3,000 and, you know, they show up to the games and the parents expect the kids to play. So I thought it'd be a good topic for today. And then a lot of rabbit holes that we can go down in within this subject itself. So what are your thoughts in terms of, especially in youth soccer, this whole idea of all the kids have to play every single game?
Yeah, so Ben, I don't know if we're going to be able to do like an hour of this because it's pretty straightforward, unless you have some specific rabbit holes that you keyed into during our last discussions. But I mean, I am not in favor for all the kids to be playing all the time, equally splitting all the time amongst the entire roster. I think that sets a very bad precedent. I think it sets a very bad set of lessons, life lessons for the kids. And just because the parents pay, that should not ensure playing time unless it's stated up front at the club, at the team level, what the policies are of the club and what the policies are of the coach and at the team level. So I think that's key to everything, is to set the ground rules and say, hey, at this club, you might be paying $100 a season, or $2,000 a season, or $5,000 a season. But that only guarantees you X, Y, and Z. And among X, Y, and Z is not any assurances as to amount of playing time. So I think that would be the right thing to do for the organization. But I'm pretty sure that's not happening. I think what's actually happening is no communication at all. And so then that's why the expectations exist of, hey, buddy, I'm paying all this money. My kid better be playing. Otherwise, you are not providing the service that I'm paying for. So I think that's key to the entire thing, Ben. And then from there, we can maybe take the conversation down a path of, okay, what if you did establish these ground rules and then, you know, A, B, and C are still happening?
Right. And I think there's a lot of instances where, you know, coaches are trying to be competitive. And then, like we mentioned, this idea of, you know, the bottom 25% of the roster. And I feel like there's coaches who, maybe there's games where it's a really close game, but this kid hasn't played and they feel pressure to play this kid and they have to throw in this bottom 25% of the roster and it costs them games. So at what point for coaches do they have to set the line of, hey, like, you know, today, little Johnny's not going to play the game? Or is it like, okay, today, you know, even though it's a close game, it's still 1-1 in the last 15 minutes. This kid hasn't played. Do I throw them in there and make the rest of the parents happy? Or, sorry, do I throw them in and upset the other parents? Or am I going to upset this one parent by not playing him the entire game? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so it's kind of like the same answer. So just like setting up front what the expectations are with respect to playing time and communicating that to the parents from a club level, team level, coach level, the same thing should happen between the club and the coach. So when you hire a coach or you start a fresh new season, you should communicate to your coaches either as a collective or one by one, because the club could have different objectives for different teams, of course. So you communicate to the coach, hey, this is the policy for how you're going to run this team. You are to play all the players, every single game, equal playing time, or you are not. So those are the two extreme scenarios. Yeah. And then you guys have a conversation and you establish some sort of set of rules as to how the coach is supposed to do playing time. Now, there are many coaches that don't like hearing that, and that's fine. This doesn't necessarily have to apply to all the coaches in the club. Maybe the more experienced coaches, maybe the more quote unquote successful coaches, don't fall under the club sort of, they don't have this sort of club relationship or club policy. Like the club says, hey, Benny, you're very experienced. You're very successful. You've had a long track record with us or long track record in the ecosystem. We're not going to put handcuffs on you. Use your own judgment and you get to do whatever it is that you want to do. And we're going to back you up. Okay. But maybe for other coaches who are fresh into the club or not as experienced or new, or maybe the club is just, it's just a certain type of club, they should communicate to that coach or that set of coaches or the entire coaches, these are the policies of the club and you shall do that. So at that point, you kind of alleviate that sort of tension, that sort of stress from the coach. So in your example, where it's a close game, it's 1-1, throw in all the hypotheticals you want at it, Ben, at least that coach has one, guidance from the club and also has the backing of the club for whatever decision they are going to make. So if they are going to make the decision of throwing in a couple of players from the bottom 25% of the roster and you end up losing, well, everybody was informed. The parents were informed and the coach was also given that shield that this is what we do at this club. So if you guys at the top end of the roster are unhappy as a consequence of us losing the game and want to leave, then so be it. And if the coach and the club kind of regret that decision because you're losing like the top end of the roster because you're losing too many games, well, maybe the club in conjunction with the coach or by themselves can reevaluate their policies and then adjust for next season or adjust on the fly and say, you know what? I think we're making a mistake by having this policy of everyone plays because we're losing all our best players because we lose games. And when we lose all our best players, and we lose all these games, the prestige and the brand of the club gets eroded and degraded, and that makes recruiting more difficult, that makes acquiring new paying customers more difficult, and the whole thing, the whole business is going to shit at that point. You see what I'm saying? And vice versa. So if you're being very win oriented, and it's kind of like what they like to say in this country, which I hate because it's stupid as hell, winning at all costs. We need to win games. Winning at all costs is retarded, okay? But if somebody's too winning at all costs and it's causing all kinds of friction and lower end of the roster is constantly a toxicity on the club or on the team and a stress point for the coaches, maybe the club can then adjust, you know, and not be so extreme and say, you know what? We're going to do equal playing time for the lower end teams in our organization, you know, because that's more rec level or whatever. But for the top end of the organization, the top teams in the club, no, we need to win games. You do not substitute in the bottom quarter of the roster, Benny, when it's a tight game and you're going for a championship or year or whatever the heck happens to be, because we want to avoid destroying our business because we need to win. So these are the sorts of things that, in my opinion, club leadership needs to be having amongst themselves and amongst the, you know, leaders in the coaching ranks, and then run the business that way. But I suspect that even to this day, that's not occurring. I think to this day, club leadership is just running an Excel spreadsheet. And whatever happens, if some bad stuff happens, they just try to put out the fire there in the moment, and they don't have a club-wide philosophy on all of this stuff.
Yeah, but even Gary, like we mentioned in the last one, like there's no really incentives for coaches to be great or for coaches and teams to win. So, you know, with the coach and a lot of
let me stop you really quick. There is an incentive for coaches to win and teams to win. The incentive is, in this environment, that is the only metric that is worth a damn at the youth level, right? It's not like promotion, you know what I mean? Because you don't get promoted for winning, but you as a coach, as a brand, you know, you elevate yourself as a coach if you win a lot, and the club elevates itself as a brand if you win a lot, even though there is no promotion to the next higher tier. Now, what I said was there was no incentive in a system without promotion or relegation is that there's no incentive to like not come at the bottom end of the table, you know, because there's no relegation there. It doesn't matter at all. It's like, oh, well, we'll be here next season. Who cares?
No, that makes sense, Gary. And I'm just thinking more in terms of like keeping for coaches, right? A lot of coaches, coaching is their only financial thing that they're getting, right? So for them, it's more so of like, kind of keeping the customers happy, if you will.
Right.
And so if you have like, you know, a lot of your players that are complaining about playing time and they're going to end up wanting to leave the team, and then, okay, all of a sudden your team is folding, then it's like, all right, like, then you feel the pressure to have to play everybody. You know what I'm saying?
It's curious what happens to coaches, because, you know, I've been in this for a very long time and I see the psychology of coaches evolve, of a particular coach, you know, and I know dozens of coaches, or however you see how they were in the beginning, you see how they were 3 years later, you see how they were 10 years later, you see how they are 20 years later. And, you know, so many folks, parents in particular, or the media in particular, paint youth coaches with kind of like a broad brush of being like a plain politics, you know, of not really caring about quote unquote development all that much. And it's because of what you just described, Ben. Their customers are the parents, and the skill that they acquire over time, more so than being a soccer coach, is being a politician. That is the skill that they are developing as a consequence of this profession. Because when parents start complaining, whether it be the top end of the roster, mid to end of the roster, the bottom end of the roster, you start crafting and adjusting your narratives and actions to try to appease all of those groups. And that you end up becoming almost like a used car, you know, the traditional cliche of a used car salesman. You know, you know how to talk to people and massage people and pacify things and, you know, do all, and even, and frankly, even lie. You know, coaches, either they lie by omission, by not telling parents, look, your kid sucks. He's just got to go. Like, who says that? Nobody says that, even though that might be the 100% unvarnished truth. You just don't say that. And you lie by omission. No, you know, Johnny, he's coming along. He's coming a long way. He's got a little bit more to go. You know, he's on an upward path. He just has to do X, Y, and Z, you know, a little bit better. And all of those things might be true, Ben, but what is not being said is their true opinion, which is, you know what, Johnny could be at this for 2 years. He ain't never getting as good as Ricardo. You know, that is never coming out of a coach's mouth. So what does that make them? It makes them a politician. It makes them like a bureaucrat. If then they start doing all spreadsheet analysis, right, of like budgeting and should we go to that tournament or this tournament and what parents should be invited, what parents should not be invited and what hotels, you know, to go to and should we have a team dinner? Should not. That is the freaking skill set of a coach nowadays instead of actually focusing on the X's and O's on the field.
Do you think the coaches should be just saying the flat out truth, even if it's harsh, or do they have to be politicians because otherwise they're not going to have a job?
No, look, we all have to be diplomatic in all areas of our life. You know, that's why politics exists. And that's how we build societies and civilization and being civil with one another is in having good cordial conversations and not being so brash and blunt. So I acknowledge what you're saying. What I am trying to emphasize is that angle, that skill set is what they are most flexing in their profession. So they are most focused on, okay, how do I respond to this text message from this parent or this club director? Or how do I answer this email? That is what they are being forced to do more than anything else. So for instance, myself at the university in teaching physics, I am focused 99% on physics and on the students and in the classroom and what are my lectures about and what problem sets, you know, I should assign and when, you know, everything is about the subject. And then 1% is reserved for, okay, how do I engage the chair of the department? How do I engage the other faculty? You know, how do I provide them feedback when they're, you know, asking questions of me? You know, so it's like 1% politics, 99% subject matter. But in youth soccer coaching, it's basically like a 50-50. 50% soccer subject matter, 50% freaking politics and management and maneuvering.
If a coach gets fired from the club, he'll have a good career as a car salesman. No? There's a lot of experience.
It's, man, I'm telling you, dude. And that's why you get, I don't know, maybe parents can chime in the comments here. Maybe I can, if a parent even wants to hop on the podcast, I'll invite them on. You know, I can have conversations with parents. Maybe I have a podcast episode with three different parents, you know, stitched together into one episode where we discuss this experience. And if you want to be anonymized, we can kind of anonymize you and make you like a deep throat and blur out your face and change your voice. No, we can do all these sorts of things. Or perhaps even better, a parent who has graduated, you know, their kids have graduated from the youth soccer scene already. They moved on and say they don't have a kid in youth soccer anymore. And they can feel free, you know, non-handcuffed and just speak their unvarnished truth. But yeah, Ben, I mean, that's the situation that coaches find themselves in. And again, I don't blame them. You are thrust into this. There is no promotion relegation. So clubs don't, their business incentives are all about acquiring and retaining, paying customers, paying parents and keeping them happy. And the parents know that they have a certain amount of influence and power because they are paying the bills.
Yeah. Something that happens a lot, Gary, I think parents are too quick to, you know, move on from a certain environment. For example, let's say their kid, it's their first year with the team, right? And maybe this kid is only getting 40% or 50% of the minutes in the games. I think they're really
That's
quick.
A lot.
To say, well, for some, it's because especially like 7v7, you're only playing 25-minute halves. Mm. So at the end of the day, okay, that's 25 minutes of playing time, right? Mm. But I think they're so quick to just move on and say, oh, this, you know, this coach doesn't like me. He's not playing that much. Let me go and find a new team. So I want to use myself as an example really quick. Like, okay, for me, you know, I wasn't the most talented player. I was on Brian's team, right? But I was playing with phenomenal players. So for my experience, you know, and this is a question I have for you, would it have been better for me to go and find a team where I played 100% of the minutes? Or is it better for me to stay on this team, play 40 to 50% of the minutes and still be in this high level environment versus going to a different team where I'm going to play 100% of the minutes, but it's with shocking players on my team?
Yeah. So this goes back to one of our episodes. I don't know what episode number it is, but the answer generally is it depends. It depends on a whole bunch of specifics. I think if I had to make a general statement for guidance, it would be, it mostly depends on the happiness of the player. So if the player is quote unquote happy or content and is in having a good time with this particular team, even though they're not playing a lot, then maybe the best decision is for that player to continue with that team. So I would always view it in that light, Benny. So if you were happy, Ben, playing 40% of the minutes or 30% of the minutes or sometimes 0 minutes, but the next game it was 60, whatever the scenario, if you were happy, you're like, oh man, I get to go to practice, or oh man, I get to go to the game and watch the team from the bench, and you're happy about that, then perhaps you continue with that. But if you're not, then the alternative is probably the wise choice. That's my perspective, my opinion, but it depends on a whole bunch of factors. The thing that usually happens, however, is it depends on the parents' happiness or the parents' level of content. And they are the ones who then end up making the decision. And frankly speaking, from my experience, many a times the kid is actually content and happy and the parent is not. And then the parent, through whatever's happening at home or off the field where we're not around, the parent kind of contaminates, and forgive the expression, guys out there, but contaminates the kid to then be unhappy with the situation, and then they move. So they won't yank the kid when they're happy, even though they're not playing a lot. They will systematically make their kid unhappy by talking shit on the coach, by talking shit on the teammates, by convincing their kid they'd be better off somewhere else and that we shouldn't stay here and that it's better for him. And then the kid systematically, you see it in their body language. You see the evolution over the course of the weeks or the months. The kid's body language turns from a joyful one to one that's not joyful at all. And then, yeah, at that point, what's best is you go. But the parents are in the driver's seat.
Yeah, Gary, you took the words out of my mind, because that's exactly what I was thinking. It's like the players oftentimes are, you can tell that like they're extremely happy and they love the team. And then all of a sudden the parent is coming in saying like, oh, Johnny's not happy, or he doesn't like this team anymore. And it all comes from the parent.
Yeah, it sucks. It really does suck, man. Look. And again, I don't want to blame anybody, and I don't blame the parents, because I also think that they're trying to do what's best for their kid. And if they believe wholeheartedly that what's best for their kid is to move on, irrespective of their level of enjoyment, okay, then they're trying to do what's best for their kid. I think generally it's probably a mistake. Sometimes they're right, but generally it's probably a mistake. But who am I? It's their kid. They get to do what they want to do with their kid.
Yeah. For players, Gary, that aren't getting the playing time that they want, you know, what can they do to improve their situation? Because I think a lot of parents think that the parent coming up to the coach and saying like, hey, you know, what can my son or daughter do? Oftentimes, I don't think that really helps the kids, you know? So what can the kids do themselves to increase their playing time or increase the minutes that they're getting on the field?
It's tough, Ben, because I think a lot depends. So let's assume that you're on a team that is quote unquote like merit-based, like playing time is more merit-based than anything. And that the coach is still kind of charitable, whereby if like the team is winning or is comfortable, and in the estimation of the coach, they're like, okay, I can put in so-and-so and we're not going to lose the game or tank the whole weekend. Then coaches will do that. And I think that's generally what ends up happening anyway, right? That coach wants to feel comfortable that putting in, you know, two or three guys from the bottom end of the roster is not going to destroy the game. So let's assume that that is the environment. What can a player do to earn more playing time? I think is very difficult, and it depends on the gap that exists between said player and the starter, for instance, in their position or their immediate competition. So if they're a central midfielder, how far ahead are the other guys from that player? Because if the gap is too wide, like, you're in big trouble. Like you can double or triple whatever it is that you're doing outside of the team environment. You can go to personal training, you can play on yourself, by yourself, you can go do pickup games. But if the gap is too wide with your competition, it might take you years to catch up. And that's assuming that your competition that's ahead of you isn't also going hardcore and improving themselves, because then the gap will always remain. It'll be permanent. Okay. So for instance, Benny, if I can use you as an example, you know, if you're playing central mid, I don't remember who were the best central mids in your position in your era, but let's just use the team, the Rage team, for example. Let's say that your competition was Prieto and Choco for playing time, okay? And I'm being sincere, you could have worked your ass off and done 20 hours extra a week in training and lifting, whatever you want. Bro, those guys have years ahead of you, you know, because they've been putting in way more work than you since they were 3 years of age, you know, so you're not catching up. You're just not going to catch up. Now, if the gap is kind of tight or kind of close, you can catch up and you can take over the other guy who has your playing time. So I think that is the primary driver, Ben.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier about like the happiness level of the player, right? But okay, for me, you just mentioned I'm never going to catch up to Prieto and Choco. So is it better, even if not considering my happiness, is it better for my development to just leave the team and go find a lower level team so that way I can be the guy?
What's your ultimate goal? Because let's not forget that you might still be developing a lot more in this environment with limited playing time than going to a lower level team and getting all 90 minutes. So I think then the question becomes, what is your ultimate objective at that point? And is it realistic? And is it realistic or is it unrealistic? Because when we say development, right?
Yeah.
When people say development, the follow-up question that needs to be asked is development for what? For what? Is it, because development could be just, oh man, you got way better at your shooting. So you developed, didn't you? Okay. Or, oh wow, you got way better at your first touch. So you developed. Okay. Cool. Development is happening. But for what? So what I mean by that is, do you want to be a pro? Do you want to, at what level of a pro do you want to be? Or do you want a Division I scholarship? Or do you just want to be able to walk on a Division I college team? Or do you want a D3 NAIA scholarship? Or do you just want to be able to play at that level? Or do you just want to be able to make the roster at that level? So there's all these gradations of ultimate objective. And then with that in mind, you can come back to your question, Benny, and say, hey, should I stay on this team that has maybe a high profile in the ecosystem, right? Maybe all the college coaches are there. Maybe it's an MLS Academy team, Ben, you know, and you barely even play. But just the fact that you're on the MLS Academy team and barely play, well, guess what? That alone will get you into an NAA school, or that alone might get you into a D1 school, you know, even though you're not playing very much. So in that situation, should that player leave and go to a team maybe that doesn't really have as much exposure, but you're playing all the time? Maybe you become invisible as a consequence of that. So I don't know. These are all the circulating hypotheticals that exist, which brings me back to the happiness question, Ben.
Yeah, that makes sense, Gary. I think another thing that especially players struggle with is sometimes, you know, early in their careers, they're the guy on their teams and they played every single minute in every game that they played. And then all of a sudden they get to high school or they get to college and, you know, all of a sudden they're not the guy. and they don't know how to handle this, you know? So I feel like, especially for players that maybe didn't get the playing time early in their career and they had to fight and earn it, I feel like they are more prepared when they get to that next level versus the guys who they've always been the guy and, you know, they expect that they're going to play 90 minutes a game. But all of a sudden, you know, you get to college and there's 15 guys that are better than you. And a lot of them, like you mentioned before, they fold and they can't handle it.
Yeah, I think so that takes us to a mentality question. That, I think, has a lot to do with the parents, frankly speaking, their home environment. And are the parents fostering a mentality development that fortifies the player and against adversity or not? And so when the player encounters those challenges at the next level, if they have been in an environment where the parent makes them mentally soft, then that's a big issue. You're going to fold. You're going to struggle. You don't know how to handle it, even though you were the starter your entire life on your amazing youth team with national championships and exposure and all this sort of stuff. And then obviously the other end of the spectrum, the parents do what I consider the right thing to do, is you kind of keep your kid grounded. So even if they are the star on their youth team, high pro and colleges are all over you or whatever the situation is, if the parents say, hey, buddy, like you're doing good, but relax. Like you ain't all, this is a big world, okay? You ain't all that. When you graduate to the next level, you're going to have to work twice as hard because it's not going to be like it is here. You've got massive competition. You might not play. Are you equipped for not playing at the next level? So that's a multi-year effort, in my opinion, from the parents' perspective, that is done through verbal and nonverbal communication with their kid in all aspects and areas of life and not just soccer. In fact, I would say soccer is probably the least important in fortifying the kid's mentality.
So it's more about, you know, like the parents, like you said, keeping the kids grounded, right? And making them make sure, like, hey, you know, even if you aren't getting every single minute, like you need to realize like it might not always be like this. And you kind of have to mentally prepare them for that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And for years, Benny, it's not just one conversation.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Gary, we've talked, you know, a lot about playing time in the youth, but I want to get your thoughts on this because I know you have a lot to say about it. For example, like MLS clubs and MLS coaches, you know, at the professional level. Do you think that the MLS coaches feel pressure from, you know, the executives in the club to play like homegrown players, like in order to, you know, keep them and keep customers coming into these MLS academies? Because if the homegrown players are never seeing the field, then it's almost like, you know, why would a parent send their kid to this academy?
There's a lot there, Benny. This is a 5-hour conversation. This is a book. Okay. First thing I need to do is correct you. And it's MLS franchises or MLS teams. They are not clubs. Okay. And that matters even in the context of your question for all questions. Look, you just said, hey, do the coaches feel pressure from executives to play like homegrowns and stuff like that? The reality is that above all the teams and franchises is the actual club, which is MLS. And MLS can drive directives, you know, to all the teams and all the franchises, some explicit, some implicit. And something that is crystal clear is that there was a quote-unquote league-wide, because I even struggle calling it a league because a league is supposed to be host to separate independent clubs and separate independent businesses. So, and that's not what MLS is. MLS is the club and it has a bunch of teams that are part of the club, you know, playing scrimmages against each other. So who runs the show? MLS runs the show. So yeah, back in 2018, 2019, it is crystal clear and people need to look at the data, or maybe I'll just put out a report at some point with all the objective facts and data that there was a huge shift in posture from the league and then consequently all the franchises that, hey man, look, all our quote unquote homegrowns are leaving and not agreeing to sign homegrown contracts anymore because of the objective fact that they were not played Okay. They weren't playing the young kids. They weren't developing the youth, and you would sign it like a homegrown, and then they would just disappear from the face of the earth. Okay. In very short order. Maybe there was one little exception or a few little exceptions, that aside. So after 2018, 2019-ish, or during that time frame, all of a sudden, like the flip of a pancake, okay, 17, 18, 19-year-olds were being thrown onto the field at all the franchises. Oh, woo, it's a free-for-all now. And so do you think that all the coaches, or a huge proportion of the coaches that happen to be in MLS during that time, just magically at the same time, they're like, oh man, hey, let's play the homegrowns. You know, this would be great for development, great for our competition. Or do you think that all the executives at all the franchises, or the vast majority of them, all of a sudden at the same time, Ben, they're like, oh man, I got it. We got to be playing our 17, 18-year-olds now. No, Benny. So this was a concerted effort to flip a switch and then start playing the kids so that no more kids would be leaving for alternatives. Okay. And one of the big alternatives was Europe or south of the border or wherever, just somewhere other than MLS. And so that is the origin of the homegrown, quote unquote, success that's been occurring since like 2018, 2019. If you'll notice now, that's kind of been degrading again. It's been degrading because they've already accomplished their objective of elevating a number of these young players. And that provided a strong signal for their youth, quote unquote, academies, their parents and their players say, oh my God, look at so-and-so, you know, he's being played like that is your path, little Johnny, or that's your future, you know? So everybody bought it hook, line, and sinker. And again, I don't blame the parents. I don't blame the players. And so that enables retention of academy products. So I don't know what the second part of your question was, but that's kind of the origin as to why the kids started to be played on the teams. It was not a to improve a team's competition level. It was not to improve resale value or to sell players into the future, because that's a consequence of all this, right? Is now all of a sudden they were also forced to accept transfer offers from overseas, whereas before, and it's notorious, you can look again, do the research, and maybe I'm gonna have freaking write shit up and put it out there on the market myself. Transfer offers would come in for young guys back in the day, and they would just be torpedoed. They would be knocked down, and no transfers would really ever happen. And so there was no opportunity for a young player or a good player to get transferred and go overseas and potentially fulfill their dream if they're good enough. And that posture also changed, you know, between 2018 and, you know, modern day, even though now modern day, it has slowed down, because once they showed the market that, oh no, this is the dream, we'll play you and we will sell you. Once they already did a good number of those things, they started going back to their old ways. So Ben, I can talk about this forever, but I don't know if that was your question. I didn't even recall it.
I was just kind of wondering, like, if the coaches had their hands forced into playing these players. But you mentioned like this idea of all these offers coming in for transfers. Like, wouldn't you think that like an MLS franchise would benefit in the fact that their kids are getting shipped off to Bayern Munich or all these big clubs, and for the players that are coming in, it's like, hey, look at the opportunity that exists here. But for them, it's more about, you know, keeping them in house and not allowing them to go overseas, which I think is wrong. And like, frankly, it's probably a big reason why the U.S. has struggled, is because we want to keep so many players here versus giving them opportunities overseas. Like, wouldn't it benefit the clubs to ship, or the franchises, sorry, wouldn't it benefit them to like get them exposure and say, hey, look, you know, we're the Colorado Rapids and, you know, Bayer Leverkusen just wanted to sign one of our players. Isn't that a good thing, Gary?
So here we have to talk a little bit about and understand something very important. What is the purpose or the function or the goal or the objectives of a franchise, okay, or of Major League Soccer. And the purpose, the objectives are not sporting related. When it comes down to it, it is a pure play on owning an asset, a very scarce asset that is owning a professional sports team here in the United States. And so that is the number one priority, is increasing the market value of that asset, like a house, okay, Ben, or like any sort of business. It's not about, ooh, actually, let me rewind. If you focus on the sporting side of the equation, oh, do we develop the best players? Do we transfer the most amount of players? Do we play the kids? That doesn't increase, that doesn't move the needle on the asset value. You with me? It's completely irrelevant. You can completely suck ass as a franchise in Major League Soccer, and your asset value just keeps going up and up and up and up and up because of its scarcity, because it's not open. There's no promotion relegation. So just squat on it. And that is the most important thing to do to increase your asset value. So when we talk about youth development or playing time for young kids, or, ooh, look, they just sold, so, you know, 22-year-old for $5 million, you know, to Bayern Munich or something like that. First off, $5 million means nothing to somebody who is worth $100 billion or $20 billion or $17 billion, which is basically the valuation, not the valuation, basically like the net worth of MLS franchise owners. So it's not like, oh my God, I'm going to make so much money. All I have to do is develop players and sell them for $3 million here and $5 million there and $20 million here. Ben, that's not the point. You see? So all of that needs to be understood before we come back to your question, which is, wouldn't it benefit the franchise to sell players? To some degree, but it's not important. It's peanuts. So like I said, if you sell a player, does the franchise or team get some revenue? Yes, it does. Does that, quote unquote, help? Sure, because that can help fund the academy, and that can help maybe fund a little piece of the salary of your next designated player, or fund a bit of the salary of the current designated player. So it's helpful. Revenue is helpful, for sure. Does it help from a public perception point of view? Yes, of course it does. Does it help for public perception in your local region, for the youth players in the local region, the families? Yeah, it helps in public perception. But from a business standpoint, it's not that important. So there is no hardcore driving incentive. Oh my God, we have to sell a player overseas, otherwise we're in trouble.
So then what is their incentives? Is it just to grow the business and to, you know, keep bringing in more money? Is that really what the top MLS exec?
The incentive is to put on a quote unquote good entertainment product and preserve your monopoly. That's it. So preserve your monopoly is number one. And then put on a good enough entertainment product so that families, you know, and people will come to the stadium, you know, and have a good night out of entertainment. And good enough so maybe, you know, a few more people tune in to games. And obviously that has been a disaster. They've really struggled with TV viewership. And that's because we have a sophisticated audience here in the United States. The vast majority of soccer people in the United States are non-MLS people, and they see the product for what it is, which is just a pure entertainment product and not a real competition. So it's just not interesting, you know, at that point. So to answer your question, though, in short, the driving forces, well, number one, preserve the monopoly. Number two, put on a good entertainment product, good enough entertainment product, so the whole thing doesn't really collapse and nobody shows up to stadiums and absolutely nobody watches. That's it.
What would happen, Gary, if the system were to open? You know, is it the executives start panicking and realize like, okay, now we have to actually start being competitive and pumping more money into our youth academies? Or, you know, what would their incentives be in that situation? Obviously, it's to not get relegated into the lower league, but, you know, at the top, what types of actions would happen?
Well, Ben, you have to be good at the sporting side of the equation at this point. now you don't really have to be good on the sporting side of the equation. And so if you have to be good on the sporting side of the equation, well, then all whoever the existing executives are, they better be much better at their jobs, okay, from the sporting side of the equation. Whoever the coaches are have to be much better. Whoever the players are have to be much better. Every single touch point in the organization has to be operating at their best for the benefit of the sporting side of the equation. And if you are not that person, well, then there's a global marketplace of technical directors. There's a global marketplace of coaches. There's a global marketplace of players. And there's going to be a frenzy, you know, to try to learn how to identify who the best are, which is a skill in and of itself, and then recruiting those people, and then, you know, competing, Benny. So I think you would have a very large overhaul of the folks, you know, at each of the franchises at that point.
Right. Gary, in terms of, you know, I feel like in MLS with a lot of these academies, they also have like, you know, feeder programs, meaning like, okay, LAFC SoCal or the Galaxy South Bay or whatever it is, right? But in these, you know, scenarios, these clubs are like charging massive fees. Like if you remember when Zlatan was playing for the Galaxy and he had this famous quote about like, this is what's wrong in the US. Like it's costing me almost $3,000 for my kid to play. So, you know, all around the world, it's not like this, Gary, right? And like the clubs are incentivized to pump money into these youth teams and programs and are not having to have a pay to play system, right? So this is another thing that would, if there was promotion relegation, right, a lot more money would be pumped into these youth clubs and environments, and it wouldn't be this, you know, you have to pay if you want to play.
Yeah, of course, Benny, of course. And we've covered that previously. And repetition is important, as we always say. Yeah, so we have to keep repeating this so it really gets absorbed. Yeah, man, when you have to be good on the sporting side of the equation, you look at every line item in the business that is a club, and you see how you can make things work such that you aren't filtering out talent based on, you know, the families having to pay. And so I know a lot of clubs have scholarship programs that would be amplified 2-fold, 3-fold, 5-fold, 10-fold, 100-fold. I don't know, because we haven't been able to live that reality where all of a sudden there is promotion relegation on the youth ranks, and then be able to see the raw numbers of Club X was operating like this, their business, and now Club X is operating like this in their business. But for sure, that is the incentive. The incentive would be to try to eliminate or reduce the pay-to-play hurdle so that you can ensure that your teams have the best talent possible.
You think we're losing out on like future top quality players just because that they can't afford to play? Like in the US, I feel like a lot of kids in, you know, South America and Europe, they get opportunities to play because it doesn't cost them much, or if anything at all. So are we losing out on a lot of quality players?
Of course, Ben. Of course. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, you froze. You froze for a second. Yeah, of course, Benny. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. We've reduced in a pay-to-play environment, you reduce the funnel, you narrow the funnel of who can get through and consequently be elevated. Opening the ecosystem opens the funnel a lot more. And now that is no longer an obstacle. And whoever's in, for instance, Ben, all these Mexican league teams that exist at the youth level who aren't in the traditional competitive club pay-to-play circuits, all of a sudden they'd be able to enter into these circuits. And guess who's playing for those teams? People who aren't pay-to-play families. And those teams and clubs, as a consequence, themselves would end up overtaking the top teams and clubs that we all come to know here in the pay-to-play environment. Actually, I take that back. Not necessarily, because those teams we've come to know as being the top teams in the competitive pay-to-play environment, they would adjust their business models to not be overtaken by the Sunday league teams and players, right? They instead would go to the Sunday league team and players' families and say, hey, come play for our prestigious club. You don't have to pay anything. We'll even get you a ride to go to and from training. Look, we have produced national team players. We have produced, you know, professional players. So you can entice them away from the existing Mexican league teams, and you'll still preserve your dominance at the top. But guess what? The funnel has now opened.
A lot of people would say, like, you know, oh, the money's not here in the U.S. to, you know, fund all these programs. But, you know, if there was a path to get to the top, like, so much money would be poured into the clubs, you know?
Absolutely. If you tell all the businesses out there, or all the potential, you know, people who would get into the business of soccer out there and are not in it at the moment, if you tell them, hey, you can marry your way to the very top of the pyramid, even if it were the very top of the youth pyramid alone, then people like me, I'd say, hey, I'd gather all my people. I'd even gather our audience. Hey, guys, let's launch a club here. And we'll start at the very bottom of the youth pyramid, and we will climb all the way to the very tippity top. And guess what? That's money that gets infused, okay? Money that I currently don't invest in creating a club or having teams, because it would be stupid for me to do that. It would be money that my investors or my partners would infuse to make this happen as well. And like me, how many people are there out there in the country? I don't know, countless people. Now, they might not know certain things about how to train a team or how to coach and all the stuff that we've been talking about the podcast for 350 some odd episodes, but that doesn't matter. That won't stop them from saying, you know what? I want to start a club of my own and inject money into the ecosystem. So the money is 100% out there, and it would be, I mean, the inflows would be crazy, Ben. Let's put it that way.
How many hurdles did you have to jump through right now, Gary, to start a 343 club? I mean, obviously, you could start maybe like a small one, but in terms of, like, you know, licensing and all these different things that you have to do to become a club. And you can only go so far, right? As of right now.
Well, look, this is something that I even stopped investigating maybe 8 years ago, because I saw what it's going nowhere, okay? So I don't know if the rules have changed or how they changed, but I can tell you what hasn't changed, and that is that you have to get by specific gatekeepers who give a thumbs up or give a thumbs down in allowing a club to exist first and foremost, and in their competitive circuit or not. And they get to choose how many teams a club has to have in order for them to compete in a competitive circuit. And they get to choose all these other requirements, written or unwritten, as to also whether we allow you to compete in a particular competitive environment or not. What we would be able to do without any issue is join like the Mexican League circuit here, because those people don't play that fucked up gatekeeping, political, fiefdom preserving bullshit, you know, that the suburbanites do. All they want to do, the Mexicans, is play, right? We just want to play, period. Oh, you want to join it? You want to enlist a team? Fucking awesome, Gary. When can you show up? Next weekend? Are you good to go next week? Because if you're good to go next week, we'll throw you into the schedule. That's how it fucking works, dude.
That's badass. Maybe we should start a team. Not only do they want to play, they have a mean ass asada. Yeah, music going. It's incredible environment.
So, but then that brings about the question of the challenge of, okay, how do you actually sustain running this operation? You know, and then your mind goes to, well, how do I sustain it? I have to do pay to play, right? If I want to grow this thing and not just be a volunteer running a team or running a club, I have to incorporate pay to play, because somebody's got to pay the bills, the field space, the registration, the uniforms, the travel, whatever the heck it is. And that is what every youth club here in the States is forced to do. They aren't doing it to rob people. They aren't doing it to get rich. They're doing it because you're forced to do that. you can run a volunteer business. And that ultimately brings us to the real problem, which is no promotion relegation at the professional level, Benny. Because if you open it up at the professional level, then the youth soccer business model shifts in a significant way from pay to play, because now you have a first team that is the real source of revenue, that is the real source of sponsorships, that is the real source or the driver for the business as a whole, and not the youth teams. So the youth teams are relinquished from being forced into the pay-to-play model.
Yeah, a lot of people want to demonize clubs and club directors, and you say, oh, you know, they're just snake oil salesmen and they're just trying to rob these parents of their money. But what you're saying is, you know, really they don't have a choice. You know, if they didn't charge, then there wouldn't be no teams and no soccer.
It's over. Yeah. It's over. It's over, Ben. Oh, and maybe the counter argument is, oh, well, you don't have to charge so much. Well, first off, have you seen the books of a club? Have you actually seen the financial books and all the details in the finances of a club and of an individual team? Because if you have not, then you're just talking out of your ass that you can charge less. And even if there was wiggle room to charge less, well, that's got to come out of somebody's pocket. And if it comes out of a coach's pocket, for instance, well, coaches are already fucking poor. It's a disaster what you guys are paid, given how much time, energy, and effort you put into it. So that's just that's a no-go, Benny. It is a no-go. Oh, well, Gary, some DOCs are making 200K or whatever the number is, Benny. Okay, so you want to take away some money from the DOC, huh? Let's say a DOC is making 200K a year. How much is his job worth? In your opinion, it should just be 100K. Okay, cool. You're taking away 100K from him. How much can you actually reduce player fees across all of your teams, right, with $100,000? How many players are in your club? 1,000? I don't know how many players are in a particular club. Okay, so there's 1,000 players in a club, and that means you're just reducing $100 off of their fees. They might be paying $3K. Okay, cool. We'll pay you $2,000. You have to owe $2,900 instead of $3,000. And that came from the DOC's pocket, which just reduced them from 200 to 100K. And that motherfucker, that DOC, you think he doesn't do anything. He works his balls off. And you know how many problems that guy has on his desk every single day of the week? I bet you in a medium-sized club, every single day of the week, this guy has parents complaining. This guy has, leagues, demanding certain things of him, or making sure all his players are registered. Oh, this person is late. That person, this person, that organization, that organization, that. Oh, they just pulled the sponsor away from the club, even if it's a tiny kit sponsor or something. Now he has to go out and talk to vendors. Oh, can we get uniforms by next month or something? Now, the guy fucking works. Okay.
Yeah. So, it's a 24/7 job.
Bro. It never stops, man. So if there's a DOC that has a decent sized club and they're making 200K, I'm not mad. Me personally, I'm not.
Well, if you're a DOC out there and you're listening, let's get you on the show.
Yeah, I'm down, dude.
It'd be a mean ass episode.
Yeah, pay to play, bro. I'm good you brought it up. And yes, we've talked about it many, many times. It makes an appearance, every other episode, but it's a big thing. And the most bothersome thing is, the general public, all they know is that that pay-to-play is a problem, a big problem. What bothers me is when they say it is the problem. No, it is not the problem. Pay-to-play is not the root. It is a consequence, guys. It is a consequence of having a closed, monopolized, non-promotion relegation ecosystem at the professional level. Let's really try to wrap our heads around that and set the record straight and start changing the minds of the folks here in the States who really have been misguided for decades.
What do you think, Gary, started all this? Because obviously you look all around the world, 99% of the professional leagues aren't like this, and it's an open system. So do you think it was just, you know, the founding members of MLS saying, like, you know, let's keep this closed, let's have this monopoly, let's make all this money, and, you know, let's gatekeep who can come into our system? Because at the time when MLS started, you know, soccer wasn't even that popular in the States for a majority of the people.
Well, soccer has always been popular in the United States. What you just said is a bullshit narrative that MLS has been feeding everybody for a very long time. Soccer has always been popular in the States, but we have had failed enterprises at the professional level at the United States. So those two things are completely different things. It is popular. It has been popular, but the professional leagues have failed. Why have they failed? Because they were never open. They were always closed, Benny. And if we want to go to this, again, multi-episode topic, but if you want to go to the previous professional league before MLS, the NASL, you know, they recruited some of the biggest names in the world at the time, from Pelé to Cruyff to who, you name the star, they, you know, they got them involved. They got them here, and the stadiums did get full, but the business model wasn't really there. The TV viewership and all these sorts of things weren't really there. And eventually it collapsed. You know, they were spending more than they were making. And so when MLS was formed, this is a multi-episode thing, Benny. When MLS was formed, look, every business wants a monopoly. Every business is fighting to have a monopoly. That is the goal of every business in one way or another. It is the job of the regulator to ensure that monopolies don't form, because it harms the ecosystem. And ultimately, it harms the consumer and it harms all the touch points of the ecosystem. But when MLS formed, yeah, a bunch of rich guys got together. They're like, hey, let's do soccer. Because that was a requirement for the USA to host the World Cup. That's the requirement that FIFA put on the U.S. Soccer Federation. And at the time, I have to rehash all my history. You know, I think it was Alan Rothenberg. You know, one of the things that was proposed is, cool, we'll form a professional league. We agree, FIFA will do that, with promotion relegation, first, second, and third tiers. And somehow, some way, that got thrown in the dumpster in favor of a monopoly. Major League Soccer was formed. And so the owners of Major League Soccer created a number of teams. A couple of the owners had multiple teams within the league at the same time. So think about that, Ben. When you talk about MLS teams being clubs, they're not clubs. If you own multiple teams in the same league, right, what are we talking about here? You feel me? And so that was the genesis of it all, Ben. And I'm not surprised that the league grew in number of teams. And I'm not surprised that the league grew in, like, attendance at stadiums, you know, over the course of time. I'm not surprised that the league has survived since 1996, because soccer is and always has been very popular in the United States. So it doesn't take a super genius to create a product where there is a lot of demand for that product, and you are the only one who is being the supplier of that product. And so it takes us to today, and we have this situation where MLS systematically has eroded everybody else in the ecosystem and is destroying competitors. From USL clubs, they're getting chop suey all over the place. When MLS says, you know what, Seattle's getting too popular as an MLS franchise, let's just basically acquire them and they'll become the Seattle Sounders, an MLS franchise and not a USL team. Same thing with Minnesota, you know, or let's put a team in Austin and destroy the USL team there. That's Austin Bold. Or let's go to San Diego, because San Diego Loyal is pretty damn good. They're making a lot of leaps and bounds, getting very popular there with the USL championship. They've proved that there is a good, healthy market and demand in San Diego for soccer. Let's just helicopter in one of our teams there and destroy them. And that's what they do, Ben. That has also been part of the business model. They chill and wait and see what USL teams develop a good market or prove the market. And they're like, ooh, let's just go over there and just take it over. And they can't take it over, because what do the people want to principally see? The mainstream soccer people, the mainstream, the suburban culture, okay, not the hardcores. What do they want to see? They want to see the major league team play, right? Instead. So then the second division team has no chance because they can't earn their way to the top, Benny. So now you have two teams. You have the major league team. It's not a coincidence that they called it Major League Soccer to differentiate themselves in name also. So all other leagues, you're not major league. You're minor. You're inconsequential, just like Major League Baseball. Yeah, it's by design, Ben. So this is what we have in our country, dude. And it really sucks, man. It really sucks because the players of the league, everybody's adversely affected, Ben. The only ones who really benefit and who are having a good time are obviously the owners of the monopoly and everybody who sucks up to the owners of the monopoly and complies and kisses the ring and bows down and licks the boot and does the bidding of what they want. They also benefit because they get to be employed, and whoever is the biggest bootlicker gets elevated the most, okay? So that is what they are competing on. They are competing on who is the best politician, who is the best bureaucrat, who is the best bootlicker, who can best elevate the monopoly, who can create the best favorable narratives for the monopoly. That is what everybody is competing on in order to get raises and get promotions and so on and so forth. You can suck ass in soccer. You can know nothing about soccer, but if you're a badass at competing on the political side of the equation and elevating the monopoly, you go up. And if you suck at that, you don't go up. And if you oppose the monopoly or say things that don't elevate the monopoly, then okay, then you're not going anywhere. Good luck, you know, coaching, staying in USL, or good luck, you know, not being elevated at the youth level. Good luck, guys. Good luck. That's what we all live through, Ben.
I'm glad you enlightened me, Gary, because, you know, I was born in 1996 when the league was formed. And so I've been brainwashed by MLS. My brain has rotten. And no, because you always hear this narrative of, oh, like soccer hasn't been that popular in the United States. But yeah, from what you're saying, it's like the market has always been there.
I haven't looked at the stats for a long time, but I'm sure they still are being preserved. We have the largest pool of registered players like in the world. We have the largest amount of like teams and clubs and stuff in the world. We have the most widely attended or the most attended World Cup in the history of all World Cups. We have teams from overseas wanting to come to the United States to play friendlies and do all this stuff. We have leagues, right, that want to play some league games in the United States, right, instead of in their home countries. Why? Because we have a world-class market here. We've always had a world-class market. Soccer is hugely popular, and the money is here to get wealthy and make money off of soccer. There's huge demand. So this whole narrative like, oh, soccer is not popular, complete horseshit. And don't bring to me the NFL numbers, you know, or the basketball numbers and all that sort of stuff. Irrelevant. Sure, is the NFL more popular? Do they have a bigger TV audience? Do they make more money than soccer in this country? Fine, sure. But look at two things. Number one is don't compare yourself to the NFL. Compare your soccer ecosystem here in the United States to the soccer ecosystems in other countries in the world, right? We have a stronger, bigger, more vibrant, more economic soccer ecosystem here in the United States than other soccer ecosystems around the world, Ben. Don't compare yourself to the NFL just so that you can say the factual statement that soccer is less popular than the NFL and that's why soccer is not big in the country. Nonsense. Uruguay has a total of a 3 million person population. 3 million. That's it. That's all they've got. Okay. And look at the quality of players that they pump out. Look at the quality of the teams that they got. Look at the quality of the managers that they've got with a 3 million person population. We have way more, a multiple number of soccer households and soccer players alone in this country than the entire population of Uruguay. We have more soccer people in this country than the entire population of Uruguay. Count the 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90-year-olds in Uruguay. Count all the kids who don't even play soccer in Uruguay. Count all the families who don't participate in soccer in Uruguay. I'm not even counting those. I'm just saying, take them all. Take the whole 3 million. We have more people in soccer in this country than the entire population of that country.
And yet we're still so far behind.
Ben, because the system is closed, they limit the supply. They limit the supply. This is basic economics. If you can limit the supply of a desired product or service, if you can limit the supply, then the value of whoever offers that product or service skyrockets. So when you look at MLS franchise valuations, and the league and everybody here who licks the boot of the league likes to cite them. You know, once a year, Forbes comes out with a list. Oh, look at the valuations of the LA Galaxy, of, you know, the New York Red Bulls. And it's like the LA Galaxy is worth $500 million, you know, or whatever the heck it is. Well, of course it's going to be worth that much because they limit the supply of teams or franchises that there can ever be in the first division. You can't earn your way into it and you can't earn your way out of it. So you're basically selling a monopoly. You are allowed a monopoly here. What's the value of a monopoly for a product or service that is in high demand? It skyrockets, Benny. Huge. Oh, but Gary, isn't that great? Isn't that amazing? You know, okay, for the business owners, it is. How about for everybody else?
Like you said, Gary, this could be a whole nother episode. You said that you're worried that we can go an hour. We're almost at an hour 15 now. So
yeah, and let me say something else. I mean, again, I'll end with this because I'm getting a little too worked up. I had a little bit too much coffee and too much Celsius, okay? Oh, well, Gary, just start your own league. Why don't you guys just start your own league, you know, and compete with MLS, and there's your meritocracy. No, you fucking moron. You can't start your own league and compete with MLS because MLS also is controlling the governing body, the regulatory body in the United States, which is US Soccer, the federation, which makes the rules of the ecosystem. So you can start your own league, and many have started their own leagues. Look at USL. Look at NASL 2 that MLS/US Soccer basically destroyed their business by not sanctioning them. And now there's a huge lawsuit against US Soccer and MLS from NASL as a consequence of that. Will they win that lawsuit? Will they not? Who knows? Who knows? And irrespective of who wins or loses the lawsuit, that does not suggest that the existing structure is a good structure or a fair structure or a just structure for all of us and for the country. It does not. All that means is that a bunch of lawyers got together, they kind of fought it out in court, and a judge said, you know, oh no, MLS, you're good, or US Soccer, you're good. It doesn't mean that is what's good for our country. But I don't even know what I was going to say, and I asked you to give me another minute. It wasn't that. Shoot.
About starting your own league?
Oh, yeah. So cool. Yeah. If I want to start my own league, dude, you just get destroyed. It's the same thing as when I suggested, oh, I'll start my own club here and compete in the youth soccer scene. Yeah, I'm not allowed to. There's a gatekeeper there that it determines whether you're allowed to compete or not allowed to compete. You think that the gatekeeper in American soccer, US soccer slash MLS, is going to say, oh, hey, but Elon Musk, you're just starting out a league and all this stuff. Cool. We're going to give you the Division I sanction also, and you can take on MLS to see who is the best Division I in the country. That ain't happening, Benny. That ain't happening. So you cannot compete. It is just as preposterous as suggesting, oh, well, Gary, you don't like the U.S. men's national team and how they do that? Start your own U.S. men's national team. Gary, why don't you just start your own U.S. men's national team and then prove who is the better U.S. men's national team? It is that level of ridiculousness what is being suggested about starting your own league.
3-4-3 league. Let's get it going.
All Latinos welcome, and all suburbanites who understand the ecosystem and how unjust it is are welcome as well.
Hey, I would want to hire you as a coach, though.
Oh, well, Gary, life isn't fair. Get used to it. It is what it is. No shit, life isn't fair. Do you see me crying? No, we have to fight for what we think is right. If everybody just looked at the world as it currently is in any respect and said, it is what it is, you know, and just no progress would ever be made ever in the history of humanity, and we'd go extinct, okay? If the cave people back in the day just... bad weather or food shortage, and they're like, oh, well, it is what it is. You know, I guess we're just all going to die in the cave now. If that was the attitude back then, we wouldn't be here today, Benny. It's always the one or the two or the small group who says, fuck it, we have a problem. We have to go solve the problem no matter what. So if food shortage, let's migrate. Let's figure it out. If we're being attacked by grizzly bears, let's get the fuck out of here. Not just say, oh, it is what it is. Let's just stick around.
Love it, G. Good stuff, brother.
Life isn't fair. Let the grizzly bear eat us.
We'd all be gone.
I just can't stand that attitude of not wanting to make things better, Benny. And I get that most people are busy with everyday life, right? And it's just too much for them. I get that. And I also get that it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. Everybody doesn't have that maybe DNA or whatever, or the environment. Not everybody's like Elon. Not everybody is like the pioneers. Not everybody is meant to be a pioneer. But what bothers me is when those folks shit on the pioneers. We are here because of the pioneers, and we will advance and solve problems because of the pioneers. They are the ones who build things. We need to support them. We need to celebrate them, not look at them like, oh, look at that. Let's cut the head off the tallest poppy seed, you know, or whatever the expression is. Why? Why are you demonizing these people? Because they see a problem and they want to solve a problem. Is it because it's a reflection on you because you are incapable of it, because you don't want to do it yourself? Is that why you want to cut the heads off of pioneers and entrepreneurs and people who want to develop solutions? It's very strange culture that's developed here, Ben. I hope it'll change. I have been refreshed, and I know a lot of people hate Donald Trump and the, you know, that whole fucking mess, right? That people have, you know, been at their throats in each other. But I feel refreshed that a lot of the values and principles that I believe this country have been founded on, and I believe are a net positive, are coming back. And I'm optimistic about that.
Yeah, I know you won't say this about yourself, but a lot of people consider you a pioneer in U.S. soccer.
Well, I consider Brian a pioneer. I think he is the tip of the spear that enabled a lot of the things that, you know, if we want to talk about 343, enabled the things that 343 has been able to do, and the people that we've been able to help has been because of him. He is the tip of the spear. He is the true pioneer on the sporting side of the equation, Ben.
All right, brother. Good stuff. Good chat.
And it's all right, man.
Sounds good, brother. Thank you.
Later, Ben. Right, thanks. Later. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers, everyone, and keep building.